So as I mentioned earlier, this is a service I do, especially when I do go to a new congregation. And for those of you who we've not talked before, I have been an interim minister for the last, on and off, 25 years. And so I've been to a lot of different churches over the years. And when I arrive, they don't really know me very much, and I don't know them very much. And so I do this service, Stump the Minister, for several reasons. One is, it's a total ego trip on my part. I wait for the time, and it has happened, when somebody will ask a question that I have no way to answer. But the second thing, and more importantly, is I often, not always, but often find out that one of the questions presented to me is the question that's on people's minds about the congregation or some issue that might need to be addressed. And that may or may not be true here. So what happens is that Peggy is going to read the questions that you have sent to her. I will not have heard or seen any of them in advance, which is, for me, the most fun, because it challenges me. So what she will be doing is reading the question once, and then a second time, and then I will do my best to answer it. I have, as I reach 70 years old, a few idiosyncrasies. Actually, a lot of idiosyncrasies. And one of them is I always sit in one of these chairs that, you know, is guaranteed to, if there's an apocalypse, these chairs will endure. They will survive anything. And I've used these chairs many times for these services. And just forgive me, because, as I said, it's one of my little idiosyncrasies. So I'm going to be sitting over there, and I'll probably stand up, but I want to sit down as I hear the question. Is that okay with you folks? Okay. The other question is, can you hear me okay this week? Okay, thank you, because I want to make sure. Last week there was apparently some issues with my speaking. And if we don't get through all the questions, which is quite possible, they will be great fodder for newsletter columns, which I'll try to answer the rest of them. All right. I am ready.
Okay. This is going to be kind of fun, and I think we'll start out with a kind of easy one. All right.
What is the nature of life in one sentence?
Exactly. Yes. Okay. What do you like best about being a minister? I guess this is a two-part one. And how has your ministry evolved over your career? Okay. What do you like best about being a minister? And how has your ministry evolved?
What I like best about being a minister is meeting new people. I chose interim ministry for a reason. I enjoy seeing new congregations like this one. And in interim ministry, and also contract ministry is what I'm doing now, you begin to see the results of the work that we do together more quickly. Interim ministry is 2 years usually, and this is a year-to-year contract. But I enjoy it because mostly I get to meet new people. I get to be in new parts of the country. What more could I ask for? How's ministry
evolved?
Okay. I have gone from a shallow-minded egotist to a more humble person over the course of years. And at this point, I would say I've learned to listen more deeply. I think I've become a little bit more authentic. And I'm still not just discovering my voice, but more importantly, your voices. And then how do those voices shape into the things that are on our minds? I think that's the best I can do.
I had these all laid out, the order I wanted to ask them, and now I'm skipping around. So, what was your religious orientation when you became interested in Buddhism? And how do you think of Buddhism in relation to Unitarian Universalism? What was your religious orientation when you became interested in Buddhism?
I became interested in Buddhism when I was about 12 years old, because I read a lot. I didn't go to school until I was 14 in high school. And so I read a great deal. We didn't go to church. I lived on a farm. And I started reading ferociously when I was about five. And I remember Buddhism, for whatever reason, just resonated with me. And I can't tell you why, and I didn't understand most of the terms, but something about it rang deeply. So that, my religious orientation at that point would have been the spirituality of the land around me, because I grew up on a 1,000-acre farm. And somehow they connected with one another. Second part?
How do you think of Buddhism in relation to Unitarian Universalism?
I think what I've seen over the last 20 years or so, since I lived in a Buddhist monastery and I was taking a time out from Unitarian Universalist ministry, is that a lot of UUs are very interested in Buddhism because it isn't, quote, theistic. It's not based on the idea or concept of a creator deity. And I think that resonates for a lot of people who are troubled by that particular theological grounding. And the Buddha was not trying to create a new religion. He was basically an early pre-industrial philosopher and psychologist of the mind. So I think that just intrigues us as well. And the third thing would be that there are some very simple rules laid out, not simple actually, around how do we awaken to our full selves? Meditation, the five precepts, and so on. They're very clearly laid out. They're not easy to follow. But for people like us who are very curious and very interested in, well, how could my life be better? This is an easier way to practice. And that's what meditation is called, is practice. It's always practice. And I think that appeals to us as Unitarian Universalists.
Which of the seven UU principles do you personally struggle with the most? And how do you deal with that struggle? Which of the seven UU principles do you personally struggle with the most? And how do you deal with that struggle?
That's kind of funny because the two I know really well are the first and the last. And all the ones in between, I kind of go, okay, whatever. I don't really struggle so much with them as to sometimes be annoyed. And I know the first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, is very, very important to Unitarian Universalists, and it is important. However, some congregations in Canada already do this, and what I tend to do a lot of the time is reverse the principles. The seventh one, the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, I start there and then move towards what we call the first one, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And I'll say one more thing about that first principle, in that I sometimes wonder if we use the word inherent in the wrong way. Just because someone has inherent worth and dignity, which they do, does not give them a get-out-of-jail-free card. around courtesy and habits and being a good person. So that has troubled me for many, many years, because I think sometimes I wonder if we struggle with the idea that sometimes people just turn out in really unskillful ways. And inherent doesn't mean we carry that worth and dignity all of our lives. I still struggle with it.
What is one decision you made in the past that you wish you could go back and undo?
One?
What is one decision, the biggest, you made in the past that you wish you could go back and undo?
Over the course of my life, I've had a number of romantic relationships. Quite a number, actually, come to think of it. And one of them, I was involved with a woman, and she and I were living together. I'm just going to say in the West, because I don't want to identify any further than that. And she got pregnant, and we were in our early 20s, and made the very hard decision about getting an abortion. And we did what needed to be done, but I still think oftentimes that those twins would be 40 years old now. And I think to myself, was our decision a wise one? Perhaps. Was it the right one? Probably. But to this day, I still think of those 40-year-old twins who do not exist. And this is why I have significant issues around the pro-life, pro-choice debate, because it's more complicated than an either or.
How do Buddhist teaching and practice integrate with the 7 UU principles? How do Buddhist teaching and practices integrate with the 7 UU principles?
Well, you folks really love the principles, don't you? I happen to like to sort the 6 sources much better, but that's okay. That's just me. I would say, going back to what we were talking about earlier, the 1st and the 7th. In the precepts and in Buddhist teachings, each person is, I think the word inherently would work well, has compassion, presence, is authentic, is capable of awakening. And awakening means nothing special except awakening to our true, authentic selves. Now, Buddhism does not believe in a self, but I'm not going to get into that discussion. But it's basically that in the Buddhist teachings, the most important person that we can be compassionate toward is ourselves. Because if we are not compassionate toward ourselves, how can we be compassionate toward others? That's really a both and. The 7th principle, the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, is very much tied to the Buddha's teachings 2,600 years ago. And there's a concept which maybe some of you have heard, I don't know, called Indra's net. Is any I-N-D-R-A-S? And I may butcher it a little bit, but the teaching, which he got from Hinduism, by the way, is that everything in the universe is connected. And so imagine a net or a web. And every piece of existence is connected. And where those pieces connect, where the web connects with each piece, it's like a sphere. It's like a mirror. And so if something happens in that piece, that space, that web, it radiates in all directions. And it's really a cumbersome way of being able to say that whatever happens in our lives, in our bodies, around us, the effects that we do and have affect others. They just don't affect us. So the seventh principle to me is really around the concept of everything is connected. And nothing and no one is left out. And I frankly think it's a beautiful phrase.
So I know we'll ask at least one more, and maybe a second. And if your question didn't get answered, Reverend Alex said that he thought that these questions would be great. He'll respond to them in the future, potentially in articles in the Oracle. So don't worry if your question didn't get asked. But I thought this one was really important to ask because it was a repeating theme. There were at least three questions that linked to this. Is there an afterlife? Ancient religions and now modern continue to ask, wonder, and sometimes have definite opinions. So that's a little bit of an introduction, but I'll ask this. What do you believe happens to one's essence of being after death? What do you believe happens to one's essence of being after death?
I'm going to answer that in two parts, and I think this may actually be the last one.
Okay.
And to whoever you folks asked that question, it's one that's been on my mind for many years. Here's the preface to it. Back in 2009, my little sister, half-sister, because I didn't live with my family, I only met Jamie in the 1980s, and we reconnected 1998 or so. And in 2009, my half-brother Jesse called me and said, Jamie's died. And it broke my heart. Because Jamie and I were like soulmates in some ways. And she died in New Mexico, and I was in Oregon. So I had to decide, was I going to go to a Buddhist retreat in Northern California, at a retreat I go to every year on addiction and recovery, or would I go to her memorial service, which was very informal, in New Mexico. And so I thought, okay, what would Jamie want me to do? Go to the retreat. So I did. I drove from Northern Oregon down to Vajrapani Retreat Center outside Santa Cruz and went to the retreat. I lit a candle when they were doing the service. And then I was driving home on I-5 outside Redding in Northern California. And I'm just driving, minding my own business, and all of a sudden I had this sense of Jamie's essence, I can't use another word for it, of being in a place of darkness, but light, colors, and some light and darkness, and it was very confusing, and uncertain and bewildering, but not frightening. And it was very powerful. And I turned to the side, I got on the side of the road, and I just, it felt a long time. It just was 2 or 3 seconds maybe. But it was my sense of her presence still. I talked later with my Zen teacher about that. And if any of you knew Tibetan Buddhism, Chosen said, well, that is the first bardo state after death, where you're going into the next stage of preparation for reincarnation. And she said, that's probably where Jamie is or was at that point. So that's part one. Part two, I've been wrestling with this for many, many years for a variety of reasons, and especially as I'm getting older, and I know that I will die. I've tried to come up with a metaphor for one possibility about what happens after death. And of course, there are many, and they all may be right. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a metaphor. Imagine yourself being on the lip of a swimming pool, a big swimming pool, and you're just standing there, and the swimming pool is filled with water, trillions and trillions of trillions of droplets of water. And just imagine each of those drops of water being a spark or a drop of consciousness, if you will, awareness. And imagine then standing there at the lip of the pool and you have an eyedropper. And in that eyedropper, there's one drop of water. And let's call that drop of water Alex. You put the droplet over the pool and you press the top of the eyedropper and the drop of water falls into the pool. And here's the question I try to ask myself, and I will ask you as well. And you don't have to answer. Does that drop of water still exist or not? Does that drop of water still exist or not? And for me, at this stage of my life, it is one way to look at what happens after we die. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you so very much for your questions, and I will continue answering them in the newsletter. And Peggy, so much, thank you so much for being willing to do this and to put them in some kind of order. Thank you, everyone.